Good evening, and welcome to Reading the Classics. My name is Lisa, and I will be concluding our story from the previous week, Murder by Proxy, by M. MacDonald Bodkin. He closed the door softly as he spoke, and locked it on the inside, leaving the key in the lock. The mask of placidity fell from him the moment he found himself alone. His lips tightened, and his eyes sparkled, and his muscles seemed to grow rigid with excitement, like a sporting dog's when he's close upon the game. One glance at the corpse showed him that it was not suicide. In this, at least, John Neville had spoken the truth. The back of the head had literally been blown in by the charge of heavy shot at close quarters. The gray hair was clammy and matted, with little white angles of bone protruding. The dropping of the blood had made a black pool on the carpet, and the close air of the room was fetid with the smell of it. The detective walked to the table where the gun, a handsome old-fashioned muzzle-loader, lay, the muzzle still pointed at the corpse. But his attention was diverted by a water bottle, a great globe of clear glass, quite full, and perched on a book a little distance from the gun, and between it and the window. He took it from the table and tested the water with the tip of his tongue. It had a curious, insipid, parboiled taste, but he detected no foreign flavor in it. Though the room was full of dust, there was almost none on the cover of the book where the water bottle stood, and Mr. Beck noticed a gap in the third row of the bookcase where the book had been taken. After a quick glance around the room, Mr. Beck walked to the window. On a small table there, he found a clear circle in the thick dust. He fitted the round bottom of the water bottle to this circle, and it covered it exactly. While he stood by the window, he caught sight of some small scraps of paper crumpled up and thrown into a corner. Picking them up and smoothing them out, he found they were curiously drilled with little burnt holes. Having examined the holes minutely with his magnifying glass, he slipped these scraps folded on each other into his waistcoat pocket. From the window, he went back to the gun. This time he examined it with minutest care. The right barrel, he found, had been recently discharged. The left was still loaded. Then he made a startling discovery. Both barrels were on half-cock. The little bright copper cap twinkled on the nipple of the left barrel. From the right nipple, the cap was gone. How had the murderer fired the right barrel without a cap? How and why did he find time in the midst of his deadly work to put the cock back to safety? Had Mr. Beck solved this problem? The grim smile deepened on his lips as he looked, and there was an ugly light in his eyes that boded ill for the unknown assassin. Finally, he carried the gun to the window and examined it carefully through a magnifying glass. There was a thin, dark line, as if traced with the point of a red-hot needle, running a little way along the wood of the stock and ending in the right nipple. Mr. Beck put the gun back quietly on the table. The whole investigation had not taken 10 minutes. He gave one look at the still figure on the couch, unlocked the door, locking it after him, and walked out through the corridor, the same cheerful, imperturbable Mr. Beck that had walked into it 10 minutes before. He found Eric waiting for him at the head of the stairs. "Well," he said when he saw the detective. "Well," replied Mr. Beck, ignoring the interrogation in his voice, "when's the inquest to be? That's the next thing to be thought of. The sooner the better." "Tomorrow, if you wish. My cousin John sent a messenger to Mr. Morgan, the coroner. He lives only 5 miles off, and he's promised to be here at 12 o'clock tomorrow. There'll be no difficulty in getting a jury in the village." "That's right, that's all right," said Mr. Beck, rubbing his hands. "The sooner and the quieter we get these preliminaries over, the better. I've just sent to engage the local solicitor on behalf of my cousin. He's not particularly bright, I'm afraid, but he's the best to be had on a short notice." "Very proper and thoughtful on your part. Very thoughtful indeed. But solicitors cannot do much in such cases. It's the evidence we have to go by, and the evidence is only too plain, I'm afraid. Now, if you please," he went on more briskly, dismissing the disagreeable subject, as it were, with a wave of his hand, "I'd be very glad of that supper you spoke about." Mr. Beck supped very heartily on a brace of grouse, the last of the dead man's shooting, and a bottle of ripe burgundy. He was in high good humor, and across the walnuts and the wine, he told Eric some startling episodes in his career, which seemed to divert the young fellow a little from his manifest grief for his uncle and anxiety for his cousin. Meanwhile, John Neville remained shut close in his own room, with the constable at the door. The inquest was held at 12:30 next day in the library. The coroner, a large, red-faced man, with a very affable manner, had got to his work promptly. The jury viewed the body steadily, stolidly, with a kind of morose delectation in the grim spectacle. In some unaccountable way, Mr. Beck constituted himself a master of the ceremonies, a kind of assessor to the court. "You'd best take the gun down," he said to the coroner as they were leaving the room. "Oh, certainly, certainly," replied the coroner. "And the water bottle," added Mr. Beck. "Well, there's no suspicion of poison, is there?" "Best not to take anything for granted," said Mr. Beck sententiously. "By all means, if you think so," replied the obsequious coroner. "Constable, take the water bottle down with you." The large room was filled with the people of the neighborhood, mostly farmers from the Berkeley estate and small shopkeepers from the neighboring village. A table had been wheeled to the top of the room for the coroner, with a seat at it for the ubiquitous local newspaper correspondent. A double row of chairs were set at the right hand of the table for the jury. The jury had just returned from viewing the body when the crunch of wheels and hoofs was heard on the gravel of the drive, and a two-horse phaeton pulled up sharp at the entrance. A moment later there came into the room a handsome, soldier-like man with a girl clinging to his arm, whom he supported with tender, protecting fondness that was very touching. The girl's face was pale, but wonderfully sweet and winsome, cheeks with the faint, pure flush of the wild rose, and eyes like a wild fawn's. No need to tell Mr. Beck that here were Colonel Peyton and his daughter. He saw the look, shy, piteous, loving, that the girl gave John Neville as she passed close to the table where he sat with his head buried in his hands, and the detective's face darkened for a moment with a stern purpose. But the next moment it resumed its customary look of good nature and good humor. The gardener, the gamekeeper, and the butler were briefly examined by the coroner, and rather clumsily cross-examined by Mr. Waggles, the solicitor whom Eric had thoughtfully secured for his cousin's defense. As the case against John Neville gradually darkened into grim certainty, the girl in the far corner of the room grew white as a lily, and would have fallen but for her father's support. "Does Mr. John Neville offer himself for examination?" said the coroner, as he finished writing the last word of the butler's deposition, describing the quarrel of the night before. "No, sir," said Mr. Waggles. "I appear for Mr. John Neville, the accused, and we reserve our defense." "I really have nothing to say that hasn't been already said," added John Neville quietly. "Mr. Neville," said Mr. Waggles pompously, "I must ask you to leave yourself entirely in my hands." "Eric Neville," called out the coroner. "This is the last witness, I think." Eric stopped in front of the table and took the Bible in his hand. He was pale, but quiet and composed, and there was an unaffected grief in the look of his dark eyes and in the tone of his soft voice that touched every heart except one. He told his story shortly and clearly. It was quite plain that he was most anxious to shield his cousin. But in spite of this, perhaps because of this, the evidence went horribly against John Neville. The answers to questions incriminating his cousin had to be literally dragged from him by the coroner. With manifest reluctance, he described the quarrel at dinner the night before. "Was your cousin very angry?" the coroner asked. "Well, he would not be human if he were not angry at the language used." "What did he say?" "I cannot remember all he said." "Did he say to your uncle, 'Well, you'll not live forever?'" "No answer." "Come, Mr. Neville, remember you are sworn to tell the truth." In an almost inaudible whisper came the words, "He did." "I'm sorry to pain you, but I must do my duty. When you heard the shot, you ran straight to your uncle's room, about 50 yards, I believe?" "About that." "Whom did you find there, bending over the dead man?" "My cousin. I am bound to say he appeared in the deepest grief." "But you saw no one else?" "No." "Your cousin is, I believe, the heir to Squire Neville's property?" "The owner, I should say now." "I believe so." "That will do. You can stand down." This interchange of question and answer, each one of which seemed to fit the rope tighter and tighter round John Neville's neck, was listened to with hushed eagerness by the room full of people. There was a long, deep drawing in of breath when it ended. The suspense seemed over, but not the excitement. Mr. Beck rose as Eric turned from the table, quite as a matter of course, to question him. You say you believe your cousin was your uncle's heir? Don't you know it? Then Mr. Waggles found his voice. Really, sir, he broke out, addressing the coroner, I must protest this is grossly irregular. This person's not a professional gentleman. He represents no one. He has no locus standi in court at all. No one knew better than Mr. Beck that technically he had no title to open his lips. But his look of quiet assurance, his calm assumption of unmistakable right, carried the day with the coroner. Mr. Beck, he said, has, I understand, been brought down specially from London to take charge of this case, and I shall certainly not stop him in any question he may desire to ask. Thank you, sir, said Mr. Beck, in the tone of a man whose clear right has been allowed. Then again to the witness. Didn't you know John Neville was next heir to Berkeley Manor? I know it, of course. And if John Neville is hanged, you will be the owner? Everyone was startled at the frank brutality of the question so blandly asked. Mr. Waggles bobbed up and down excitedly, but Eric answered, calmly as ever, That's very coarsely and cruelly put. But it's true? Yes, it's true. We will pass from that. When you came into the room after the murder, did you examine the gun? I stretched out my hand to take it, but my cousin stopped me. I must be allowed to add that I believe he was actuated, as he said, by a desire to keep everything in the room untouched. He locked the door and carried off the key. I was not in the room afterwards. Did you look closely at the gun? Not particularly. Did you notice that both barrels were at half-cock? No. Did you notice that there was no cap on the nipple of the right barrel that had just been fired? Certainly not. That is to say, you did not notice it? Yes. Did you notice a little burnt line traced a short distance on the wood of the stock towards the right nipple? No. Mr. Beck put the gun into his hand. Look close. Do you notice it now? I can see it now for the first time. You cannot account for it, I suppose? No. Sure? Quite sure. All present followed this strange and apparently purposeless cross-examination with breathless interest, groping vainly for its meaning. The answers were given calmly and clearly, but those that looked closely saw that Eric's nether lip quivered, and it was only by a strong effort of will that he held his calmness. Through the blandness of Mr. Beck's voice and manner, a subtle suggestion of hostility made itself felt, very trying to the nerves of the witness. "We'll pass from that," said Mr. Beck again. "When you went into your uncle's room before the shot, why did you take a book from the shelf and put it on the table?" "I really cannot remember anything about it." "Why did you take the water bottle from the window and stand it on the book?" "I wanted a drink, but there was none of the water drunk." "Then I suppose it was to take it out of the strong sun." "But you set it in the strong sun on the table." "Really, I cannot remember all these trivialities." His self-control was breaking down at last. "Then we will pass from that," said Mr. Beck a third time. He took the little scraps of paper with the burnt holes through them from his waistcoat pocket and handed them to the witness. "Do you know anything about these?" There was a pause of a second. Eric's lips tightened as if with a sudden spasm of pain, but the answer came clearly enough. "Nothing whatever." "Do you ever amuse yourself with a burning glass?" This seemingly simple question was snapped suddenly at the witness like a pistol shot. "Really, really," Mr. Waggles broke out, "this is mere trifling with the court." "That question certainly does seem a little irrelevant, Mr. Beck," mildly remonstrated the coroner. "Look at the witness, sir," retorted Mr. Beck sternly. "He does not think it's irrelevant." Every eye in court was turned on Eric's face and fixed there. All color had fled from his cheeks and lips. His mouth had fallen open, and he stared at Mr. Beck with eyes of abject terror. Mr. Beck went on remorselessly. "Did you ever amuse yourself with a burning glass?" No answer. "Do you know that a water bottle like this makes a capital burning glass?" Still no answer. "Do you know that a burning glass has been used before now to touch off a cannon or fire a gun?" Then a voice broke from Eric at last, as it seemed in defiance of his will, a voice unlike his own, loud, harsh, hardly articulate. Such a voice might have been heard in the torture chamber in the old days when the strain on the rack grew unbearable. "You devilish bloodhound!" he shouted. "Curse you! Curse you! You've caught me! I confess it. I was the murderer." He fell on the ground in a fit. "And you made the son your accomplice," remarked Mr. Beck, placid as ever. A few fables today from Aesop. Aesop was a Greek who lived about 600 BCE, and over the centuries, many stories have been attributed to him, either correctly or incorrectly, and these stories often are short little fables with a moral, and oftentimes have animal characters in them, and those morals, even to this day, are popular in contemporary culture and are often used as adages. And so we'll start off with one of the classic ones. The Shepherd's Boy. There was once a young shepherd boy who tended his sheep at the foot of a mountain near a dark forest. It was rather lonely for him all day, so he thought upon a plan by which he could get a little company and some excitement. He rushed down towards the village, calling out, "Wolf! Wolf!" And the villagers came out to meet him, and some of them stopped with him for a considerable time. This pleased the boy so much that a few days afterwards he tried the same trick, and again the villagers came to his help. But shortly after this a wolf actually did come out from the forest and began to worry the sheep, and the boy, of course, cried out, "Wolf! Wolf!" still louder than before. But this time the villagers, who had been fooled twice before, thought the boy was again deceiving them, and nobody stirred to come to his help. So the wolf made a good meal off the boy's flock, and when the boy complained, the wise man of the village said, "It is your own fault if, after so often taking your lie for a truth, we at last took your truth for a lie." The moral being, a liar will not be believed even when he speaks the truth. The next story is The Ostrich and the Pelican. The ostrich one day met the pelican, and observing her breast all bloody, "Good God," says she to her, "what is the matter? What accident has befallen you? You certainly have been seized by some savage beast of prey, and have with difficulty escaped from his merciless claws." "Do not be surprised, friend," replied the pelican. "No such accident, nor indeed anything more than common, hath happened to me. I've only been engaged in my ordinary employment of tending my nest, of feeding my dear little ones, and nourishing them with the vital blood from my bosom." "Your answer," returned the ostrich, "astonishes me still more than the horrid figure you make. What, is this your practice, to tear your own flesh, to spill your own blood, and to sacrifice yourself in this cruel manner to the importunate cravings of your young ones? I know not which to pity most, your misery or your folly. Be advised by me, have some regard for yourself, and leave off this barbarous custom of mangling your own body. As for your children, commit them to the care of Providence, and make yourself quite easy about them. My example may be of use to you. I lay my eggs upon the ground, just cover them lightly over with sand. If they have the good luck to escape being crushed by the tread of man or beast, the warmth of the sun broods upon and hatches them, and in due time my young ones come forth. I leave them to be nursed by nature and fostered by the elements. I give myself no trouble about them, and I neither know nor care what becomes of them." "Unhappy wretch," says the pelican, "who hardens thyself against thy own offspring, and through want of natural affection renderest thy travail fruitless to thyself? Who knowest not the sweets of a parent's anxiety, the tender delights of a mother's sufferings? Is it not I, but thou, that art cruel to thy own flesh? Thy insensibility may exempt thee from a temporary inconvenience and an inconsiderable pain, but at the same time it makes thee inattentive to a most necessary duty, and incapable of relishing the pleasure that attends it, a pleasure the most exquisite that nature hath indulged to us, in which pain itself is swallowed up and lost, or only serves to heighten the enjoyment." The moral being, the pleasures of parental fondness make large amends for all its anxieties. The next story, The Mimic and the Countryman. Men often judge wrong from some foolish prejudice, and whilst they persist in the defense of their mistakes, are sometimes brought to shame by incontestable evidence. A certain wealthy patrician, intending to treat the Roman people with some theatrical entertainments, published a reward to anyone who could furnish out a new or uncommon diversion. Excited by emulation, the artists assembled from all parts, among whom a mimic well known for his arch wit gave out that he had a kind of entertainment that had never yet been produced upon any stage. This report being spread about brought the whole city together. The theater could hardly contain the number of spectators. And when the artist appeared alone upon the stage, without any apparatus, without any prompter or assistant, curiosity and suspense kept the spectators in a profound silence. On a sudden, the performer thrust down his head into his bosom and mimicked the squeaking of a young pig so naturally that the audience insisted upon it he had a real pig under his cloak and ordered him to be searched. Which being done, when nothing appeared, they loaded the man with encomiums and honored him with the most extravagant applause. A country fellow, observing what passed, "Faith," says he, "I can do better than he," and immediately gave out that he would perform the same thing much better the next day. Accordingly, greater crowds assemble. Prepossessed, however, in favor of the first artist, they sit prepared to laugh at the clown rather than to judge fairly of his performance. They both came out on the stage. The mimic grunts away first, is received with vast applause and the loudest acclamations. Then the countryman, pretending that he had concealed a little pig under his clothes, which in fact he did, plucked the ear of the animal and by the pain forced him to utter his natural cry. The people exclaimed aloud that the first performer had imitated the pig much more naturally and would have hissed the countryman off the stage. But producing the real pig from his bosom and convincing them by a visible proof of their ridiculous error, "See, gentlemen," says he, "what pretty sort of judges you are." The moral being, there is no error too extravagant for prepossession and partiality. Next story is The Wolf and the Mastiff. A lean, half-starved wolf inadvertently strolled in the way of a strong, well-fed mastiff. The wolf, being much too weak to act upon the offensive, thought it most prudent to accost honest Towser in a friendly manner, and among other civilities, very complacently congratulated him on his goodly appearance. "Why, yes," returned the mastiff, "I am indeed in tolerable ease, and if you will follow me, you may soon be altogether in as good a plight." The wolf pricked up his ears at the proposal, and requested to be informed what he must do to earn such plentiful meals. "Very little," replied the mastiff, "only drive away beggars, caress my master, and be civil to his family." To these conditions the hungry wolf had no objection, and very readily consented to follow his new acquaintance wherever he would conduct him. As they were trotting along, the wolf observed that the hair was worn in a circle round his friend's neck, which raised his curiosity to inquire what was the occasion of it. "Nothing," answered the mastiff, "or a mere trifle. Perhaps the collar to which my chain sometimes fastened." "Chain?" replied the wolf, with much surprise. "It should seem, then, that you are not permitted to rove about where and when you please." "Not always," returned Towser, hanging down his head. "But what does that signify?" "It signifies so much," rejoined the wolf, "that I am resolved to have no share in your dinners. Half a meal with liberty is, in my estimation, preferable to a full one without." The moral being, a mere competence with liberty is preferable to servitude amid the greatest affluence. The next story is The Swallow and Other Birds. A swallow, observing a farmer employed in sowing hemp, called the little birds together, informed them what he was about, and told them that hemp was the material from which the nets, so fatal to the feathered race, were composed, advising them unanimously to join in picking it up in order to prevent the consequences. The birds, either disbelieving his information or neglecting his advice, gave themselves no trouble about the matter. In a little time the hemp appeared above ground. The friendly swallow again addressed himself to them, told them it was not yet too late, provided they would immediately set about the work, before the seeds had taken too deep root. But they still, rejecting his advice, he forsook their society, repaired for safety to towns and cities, and there built his habitations and kept his residence. One day, as he was skimming along the street, he happened to see a large parcel of those very birds imprisoned in a cage on the shoulders of a bird-catcher. "Unhappy wretches," said he, you now feel the punishment of your former neglect. But those who, having no foresight of their own, despise the wholesome admonitions of their friends, deserve the mischiefs which their own obstinacy or negligence brings upon their own heads. The moral being, some will listen to no conviction but what they derive from fatal experience. The next story is The Stag Drinking. A stag, quenching his thirst in a clear lake, was struck with the beauty of his horns, which he saw reflected in the water. At the same time, observing the extreme slenderness of his legs, "What a pity it is," said he, "that so fine a creature should be furnished with so despicable a set of spindle shanks. What a truly noble animal I should be, were my legs in any degree answerable to my horns." In the midst of this soliloquy, he was alarmed at the cry of a pack of hounds. He immediately flies over the forest and left his pursuers so far behind that he might probably have escaped. But, taking into a thick wood, his horns were entangled in the branches, where he was held till the hounds came up and tore him in pieces. In his last moments he thus exclaimed, "How ill do we judge of our own true advantages! The legs which I despised would have borne me away in safety, had not my favorite antlers betrayed me to ruin." The moral being, the false estimate we often make in preferring our ornamental talents to our useful ones. And our final story, The Fox and the Stork. The fox, though in general more inclined to roguery than wit, had once a strong inclination to play the wag with his neighbor, the stork. He accordingly invited her to dinner in great form, but when it came upon the table, the stork found it consisted entirely of different soups, served up in broad, shallow dishes, so that she could only dip in the end of her bill, but could not possibly satisfy her hunger. The fox lapped it up very readily, and every now and then, addressing himself to his guest, desired to know how she liked her entertainment, hoped that everything was seasoned to her taste, and protested he was very sorry to see her eat so sparingly. The stork, perceiving she was played upon, took no notice, but pretended to like every dish extremely, and at parting pressed the fox so earnestly to return her visit that he could not in civility refuse. When the day arrived, he repaired to his appointment, but to his great mortification, when dinner appeared, he found it composed of minced meat served up in long, narrow-necked glasses, so that he was only tantalized with the sight of what it was impossible for him to taste. The stork thrust in her long bill and helped herself very plentifully. Then, turning to Reynard, who was eagerly licking the outside of a jar where some sauce had been spilled, "I'm very glad," said she, smiling, "that you seem to have so good an appetite. I hope you'll make as hearty a dinner at my table as I did the other day at yours." Reynard hung down his head and looked very much displeased. "Nay, nay," said the stork, "don't pretend to be out of humor about the matter. They that cannot take a jest should never make one." The moral being, we should always reflect, before we rally another, whether we can bear to have the jest retorted. So there are many collections of Aesop's fables, and they've been translated and adapted many times over the centuries. The edition that I was reading today was from 1897, which is why some of the language was a little bit archaic. But there are more modern translations, and if you would like to find more information about Aesop himself, the Children's Library has a new biography of him on their shelves. Thank you.